the Playwright, a podcast about creating and sharing new ways to play, and welcome to a new year of Playwright. I guess we celebrate our years as anniversaries of the original recording, but it's a new year in the objective Gregorian sense. So, that's not it. Gregorian of the chants. Who does the calendars?
I think it's also so the Gregorian calendar, isn't it?
Pope Gregory had his hands full in ways that still affect us today. I guess how many people are listening to Gregorian chants these days? Maybe that's a bad example. Just me? Just me. Anyways, my name is Ryan Heyman. You can call me H.
And I'm Ryan Quintel. You can call me Q.
Q, what have you, did you do anything for the new year?
My wife and I, so we have, my wife and I have an IKEA kitchen table. Are you ready for the most domestic, boring story?
Hey, that's why I tune into Playwright.
That's right. Here we go. Yeah, here's some normalcy. My wife and I have this crappy IKEA table. We've been living with it for a long time, and we finally decided that we wanted to do something more. We weren't really happy with a lot of the tables we were seeing. It wasn't like something that we felt like so much stuff now. If you want to go get a nice thing that would have been made of wood 20 years ago, are all now made of some compressed, weird, fibrous thing with a veneer. So we found a local lumber place that does reclaimed wood, actually mostly from like tractor trailer beds. Or not even tractor. Yeah, I think whatever the big, you know, the giant trucks are that, you know, Amazon ships everything around in.
But okay.
Yeah. And they are going to make us a table. That's what they do. They kind of take these boards, reconstruct them, finish them, and all the stains and stuff that you want. And we've got some steel Floyd legs. So we're kind of assembling in pieces our perfect table, and we're going to do a bench so that we have, like, hopefully one day if we get together in person, H, like, you'll be able to come and enjoy hopefully a very warm, welcoming dining experience with the Quintel household. So,
well, yeah, I'll look forward to that. I know that you had invited us out to Colorado just for a little visit before COVID started. We haven't been able to take advantage of that because obviously nobody's been going anywhere. And at this point, it seems like, I mean, the invitation is revoked by default. I think that's the safe assumption to make.
Yeah.
You know, because it is either at that point I invite you to risk your own health to travel out here, or to risk my health by traveling here. And so, yeah, but we do intend to at some point in the future maybe do a live episode. Maybe we can chat some game ideas back and forth, but we've never actually met in person. But I think we do a pretty good job of keeping the rapport without having that that face-to-face interaction.
It's interesting, right? After 3-4 years of doing this now, which is almost the entire span of I think I've only got 1 year in my relationship with my wife on our time together. So I it's one of those things where I can't help but, you know, when there's world events like there has been this past week, and we're not going to delve into that sort of stuff. But when there's those things, when there's even just New Year, Christmas, I do find myself thinking about you. So you're always in my thoughts, if that's any.
Oh, well, thank you.
Anything nice.
It's been a fun journey, but let's continue that journey today with a video game pitch. You are going to be going first today.
Okay. So my pitch this week is actually inspired by a terrible experience I had over break, but also a fantastic one. So the terrible experience.
You were in Washington, D.C. and
jeez.
No, I'm sorry. You go ahead.
God, we need a whole second podcast just to talk about this type of stuff. But yeah, I saw Wonder Woman 84. Did you see this?
I did not.
Okay, it was bad to me anyway.
That's what I've heard. I've heard people aren't that enthusiastic about it, which is too bad because I don't know. The last Wonder Woman, people seemed to really be on its side.
Yeah. It was a shame. We really did. I liked the first one. This was just a really terrible, I think, follow-up for many ways. There's some things that are kind of great about it, but on kind of the internet's recommendation, people were talking about this story called Wonder Woman Dead Earth, which is kind of a series of comics now, a hardcover graphic novel that is this kind of standalone Wonder Woman story. And it's really fascinating. It takes place during what is a post-apocalypse. and Wonder Woman is kind of, she plays this figure who is attempting to partner up and guide the last remaining kind of living humans to some kind of salvation. She's trying to save what's left of humanity. And so the pitch, this is all a long way of saying the pitch is Oregon Trail in the post-apocalypse, but you are, it could also be something of a superhero-esque casual or a character action game of sorts where you are playing a superhero, playing Wonder Woman. You've got this caravan of humans, and I could see all sorts of mechanics where, like, there's 1,000 humans left in the world, and throughout your, you know, point-to-point journey, you might be able to be measured on how many of their lives you lose and dealing with, you know, resources like starvation and having to be someone who both has these incredible superhero powers and you're defending them against their sort of wasteland monsters and that sort of stuff, but also be measured on how many humans you keep alive till you get to your safe place.
Interesting. Let's start the clock. There's a another game I wanted to reference here. It's a game called The Useful Dead. Not a super popular one, but it was a platformer in which you controlled a kind of a set number of these kind of cute little animal avatars. But the premise was basically that, like, many of the stages, I think you could complete everything without dying, but you only had 100 of these characters from the beginning of the game, and their lives don't, you know, restock at any point. Like, you just have to get as far as you can get in the game with your set number of lives and characters. And as the name comes from, as the characters died by falling on spikes or, you know, whatever, then, you know, necessarily their bodies become platforms in a way as well. And so it becomes a little bit less dangerous for the next creature to pass through there. So if you had, you know, fallen in a spike pit, then the space that is occupied by the dead body of the previous character is now a safe stepping stone so that you can more easily navigate it next time. So a bit grim, but I do like these ideas of some sort of a permanence to the run. Also makes me kind of think of XCOM and think about, like, kind of global preparedness and thinking about, even if you do have a kind of a set number of characters, they might not all be in one place. If this is kind of an interplanetary or a regular planetary, intraplanetary scale mission about, you know, protecting humanity, then it could be about dividing your attention between kind of a limited set of heroes, sending them to deal with different threats in different corners of the globe and how that might affect, you know, populations in different areas. I don't know. I think there's a lot to think about.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, right? Because I think the book makes reference to, or the story makes reference to, there being about 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. So the idea of both those kind of sequences that we see in, like, cinema over and over again, like the sort of Lawrence of Arabia or the great migration of people from one spot to another. But also thinking about, for me, the way that the Red Dead 2 camp kind of always needed some kind of money or always needed some kind of resource. And you were asked by the people as you built relationships with them to go help them out by getting these things. And so I like the idea of Wonder Woman starting off kind of very alien. She wakes up in this world. She's been, I don't know, in some sort of stasis, I guess, since the world falls apart and this all happens. And so she's a stranger to this world. People don't know, you know, who superheroes are, that sort of thing. But she's also, she could hunt and, you know, catch a pig, catch a cow, I'm assuming that those are left, in a way that would be maybe incredibly inefficient or put people's lives at risk. So she is uniquely positioned to be everything in a way to these people, including a leader. So I could see there being, you know, Assassin's Creed-esque type of you know, going out, collecting resources, being able to hunt animals mechanics, or even being able to, as Wonder Woman, scout ahead and, you know, take out a camp of monsters or those sorts of things in order to ensure the path ahead always happens. But I do like the idea of each there being time, and each passing day, your group is going to migrate a certain amount, and like at the beginning of the day, to make decisions for the group of, are we going to take this path or this path? And in a way, you almost create an exotic type of, or the old Star Fox, like, do you want lane A or lane B? And so multiple playthroughs could feel very different depending on, like, did you go around the mountains or did you try and go through the mines, you know, Lord of the Rings style?
I think one of the things that I found interesting in your description there, I wish I'd played more Age of Mythology, because it's kind of a similar type of, you know, strategy game in which you're trying to kind of Age of Empires, like, expand your civilization, and then you have the assistance of one of the gods from Greek mythology. I don't know if there was any kind of sense of them being as dangerous and difficult to appease as they were in Greek mythology, but I think that's an interesting balance as well. Like, you have to think about the ego of the hero, of very kind of like Watchmen-like, where you have this one unit that can do the work of 100 units very easily. You know, you have your humans, which you can send out to do tasks and stuff like that. It's like, you know, getting out there and doing an honest day's work for the reward that it brings. And then you have your hero that that can do things much more easily. But if you spend too much time relying on the hero, maybe it causes the hero to think of themselves as like a god. Maybe it makes them more likely to disobey or to start demanding things of the civilization, of the citizenry. Maybe they become more of a liability the more responsibility that they're given. I don't know.
I do think, too, if you don't go for more of the open world and more is more kind of format, there could be an opportunity in story beats to have Wonder Woman responsible for making decisions for the group, right? Like, if this is post-society and in many ways, like, in order for humanity to move forward, they're going to have to discuss, like, what is not okay and what should the punishment for not being okay is. And I think this is even partially inspired by Battlestar Galactica, which I've been making my way through for the first time. I've seen the first season before, but now we're kind of watching the rest of it. And, you know, the president in that show has a board that's like 49,000, you know, 750 people. And every single time one single number goes down, it hurts, right? And so I would appreciate the game kind of reinforcing that like every one of these people matters, and you're going to need as many as you can in this new world. So how do you make the choices to deal with people? How do, you know, if without the proper repercussions, speaking of this past week, without the proper repercussions, what long-term effects does it have on the group? Do you have to suffer through the group trying to split and all of those things? But yeah, that kind of feeling of a caravan, but a place where the superhero powers aren't necessarily making you lord over people, but rather be one of the most, you know, utilitarian creatures that exists in this world.
Perhaps there's interest in thinking about maybe being able to choose the scope of the civilizations that you want to save. Maybe you do want to be a global hero and get the most out of spreading yourself thin across the entire world to save, you know, people from the various threats. Maybe it makes it more difficult to juggle. Maybe you just want to be the hero of one particular group or country and really, really nurture and really, really hone in closely with that one group and make sure that, you know, if nothing else, then at least these few people make it to the finish line. But, you know, maybe as you incorporate different groups or different nations, then they could even have conflict between themselves. And so you have to not only think about the threats from without, but also to think about the internal struggles that the group might have if the net is cast too wide.
You know, in classic Playwright fashion, I think you've also uncovered something interesting here, which is, you know, people ask the question, could there be such thing as a good Superman game? and I think one potential answer to that, to what you just said, is even if you said it in modern day, it wasn't a dystopia, you know, all of that sort of stuff. The idea of, like, at the beginning of the Superman game, choosing kind of your what amount of the globe do you think you're going to be able to cover in this playthrough, and just mm-hmm. always having the pressing, like, you're not even finished with them. It would almost feel like overcooked orders coming in, right? Like, you're not even finished saving this person, where now something's going down in Russia, now something's going down in China, and you're this sort of, how do you manage it all and who don't you save aspect of a superhero, which I think, you know, good superhero stories can grapple with.
Interesting. Obviously this layers into very interesting discussions about bias and global politics and stuff like that. But we are out of time there. So we're going to have to close that down. But of course, as always, interested in further feedback and development by the community, if you have an interest in doing so. For now, let's come up with a name for what we have.
Well, the name of the graphic novel is Wonder Woman Dead Earth, and I think you could do this in the same name, but if we've got something better.
Dead Earth is a nice name. That's I think it's very evocative.
Yeah. Yeah. The art in this thing too, if you get a chance, just Google some of the imagery. It's in that kind of everything feels almost filthy, if that makes sense.
All right. Dead Earth. Thank you very much. Let's go over to my pitch. Today, I'm going to be proposing a Bloodborne direct sequel.
If they won't make it, you will.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I'm going to have to do it myself. I was thinking about, like, Bloodborne feels like such kind of an open and shut case in and of itself. It feels so standalone for what it is. And so much of the journey of Bloodborne was uncovering the different layers of this kind of infection and sickness on humanity, and seeing how crazy things became when the pages started being peeled back. I don't know if we can really kind of, like, get that same narrative again from going from, like, a werewolf fiction to essentially, like, a Lovecraft fiction. Like, that was a surprise the first time around. It's not going to be a surprise in the sequel, but I was thinking of ways of preserving some of that necessary flavor. And I was also wanting to do something that felt mechanically different from any Souls game before. So instead of a kind of spokes coming off of a hub type of approach that you've seen from the later Souls games, I wanted to really, really double down on the interconnected world of Dark Souls 1 and make it even more customizable in the way that you can affect the world. And so what I want to do is basically create a Bloodborne type sequel in a city. All takes place in one city, one very big city, but it's a layered city, thinking like Edinburgh or Seattle, where there will be kind of an old town that either kind of fell to a earthquake, or there was, maybe it's just, like, you know, due to the grounds being too dirty and filthy and polluted, that people just kind of build upwards. And eventually, you know, the second story of a building, they just kind of build a new street level at that level, and the second story becomes the first story. And then there's another layer of the city buried underground. And so I was thinking about this type of imagery of cities built on top of previous versions of the same city, and thinking, you know, that can go four or five layers deep. So I was thinking that, that the overworld is civil and full of humans, and, you know, everyone's a little bit weird because it's a Souls game, but, you know, it's the place
yeah,
where you
laugh
go
at you
to
for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you'll go to shop and things aren't immediately bad up there. This is where you do your shopping, you're leveling up, all of that. Going underground is where you start to encounter monsters. You know, it's kind of like the Chalice Dungeons in Bloodborne. The darkness produces monsters, as does a kind of corrupting force that kind of seeps through and emanates from underground. And so, you know, the darkness creates the kind of werewolf monsters, the corrupting force creates the kind of Lovecraftian type things. You'll encounter more of those as you traverse to lower and lower levels. But the thing is here, to activate checkpoints, kind of like the bonfires and lanterns in the previous Souls games, you would need to break a hole in the ceiling to let some of the sunlight or the moonlight or whatever it is, the natural light into this next layer to shine on a lantern. And so as you break more of the ceiling of one layer, obviously that kind of affects the floor of the layer up from that. And it lets some of the monsters out into upper layers. It lets some of the corrupting force from the lowest layers up into the higher layers. And so as you venture down, you have to make the choice as to how much of the world to break apart, to allow yourself to gain those necessary checkpoints or to create shortcuts between areas. And eventually, like, you're given the choice to, you know, if you break enough of the structural support, then entire rooms or entire buildings can collapse. And now that is a part of the map. And, you know, it's not procedural, it's not random. Every level of destruction that you can complete creates an interesting kind of Souls-like level layout. It's just that you get to choose yourself how much of the civility and safety of the upper layers you want to maintain as you go deeper and as you try to find your way to the core of this layered city. So I'm going to go ahead and start the clock there.
I mean, I'd love this. One of the things that I think could use updating, freshening up, revisiting, whatever you want to say, from the current Soulsborne type stuff is a little bit more control over where I'm going to say is a safe space or what I'm going to say is a checkpoint. Mm-hmm. Just because I think I understand that the worlds are so crafted around what those points are. But like you said, the trade-off of the checkpoint in the current format is make yourself have to face the same challenges maybe that you overcame and put yourself back in danger, but making it's almost like you're, what's that term that Souls uses, like world tendency?
Yeah.
I could see using the breaking apart and the you know, shining the light through mechanics be something that is almost also a world tendency mechanic, is, you know, suddenly up and it's less safe than you thought. I also like the idea, if you're three layers deep, or if you're two layers deep, even you must start with potentially breaking through at least a piece of the area where light was shining in previous layer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's necessary to have a somewhat contained version of the city, so like layout that is recognizable from the top layer, the safe layer that you can explore. And so, you know, buildings kind of have the same shape as you go lower, so that you always know roughly in the grand scheme of things where you are. You know, you're like, oh, I'm in this building at the very top level. It's a hospital. Next layer down, it's where I found a nest of crow people. And then the next layer down is where I am now. And so, you know, even if the substance of the world changes, I think having continuity of shapes of walls and of basic layouts to shapes, I think that's useful. And it even kind of provides some interesting flavor for the above layers, because you have to think about, like, when the people were building the next layer up, they knew what was underneath. They knew that they were building this orphanage on top of a burial ground, you know, like, this isn't a surprise to anyone. But as you go deeper, it adds more kind of sinister intrigue and language to the spaces that you've already inhabited. Another thing I was thinking about from inspired by Vampyr, which was in turn inspired by Bloodborne, a action game that was put up by Don't Nod. That game was set in a city and had a set number of NPCs, and you could choose to either let them live and, you know, they are useful throughout the, you know, duration of their life, or you could choose to, you know, as a vampire, suck their blood and gain some additional vampire power and they stay dead forever. And so, you know, obviously enemies would respawn, but maybe if you're anticipating on that top layer, especially a corrupting force coming through, you know, you're going to have to break a hole in the floor of one particular building and it's full of NPCs. Maybe there is some sort of utility in going in there while everyone's still friendly and human, basically killing everyone there because you know that they're going to become a respawning mob of monsters in an otherwise useful space for you later. And so it's coming up with like those types of moral questions, you know, of, you know, like the zombie movie, do you shoot your partner before they fully transform into a zombie because you know what's coming? And then if you kill people who are not themselves monsters yet, maybe it kind of sets a police force against you. That's kind of a mob in the upper layer that you would have to deal with at that point. And so, yeah, as you know, as monsters enter the upper layer, or as you yourself kill people in the upper layer, it does start to kind of affect the social atmosphere and levels of panic and of how people interact with others. And it could affect not only the layout of the world, but also the kind of social structure as it goes.
I think one thing that might be kind of interesting is this idea of, In the Souls games, there might be a large architectural feature or, you know, an ominous location that you feel like you're marching towards. You first approach it and see it in the distance. In many ways, I'm thinking about like our castles and these things, and you just like, you know, seeing it in the distance, you're like, I'm working my way towards it, but I know whatever's in it is not going to be good. And I, what do you think about for each layer of the city, knowing that there is going to be the city hall, and that city hall is going to contain what is the worst of, the scariest of, it is your boss location. But, and I even like in terms of hub and spoke, imagine city hall, like on each layer, always being the core of the city. But you know, so all city halls are kind of built on top of each other. You can never quite checkpoint at a city hall. You really have to checkpoint somewhere off and around it and make your way towards city hall. But because I control my checkpoints, you know, I do have some lever of control. But I do love the idea of the layering, the it's darker and darker, and even like trying to find either tools, items, solutions to manage that darkness throughout.
I think when it comes to darkness, you know, I'm still really disappointed we never got the version of Dark Souls 2 that was originally intended, where it was like really, really dark throughout the game and you had to choose to carry either a torch or a shield. You know, that was the kind of core conceit that the game was built around, and they found that the tech couldn't support the vision that they were going for, and so instead you got a pretty bright and easy to see game world that was not offering the appropriate level of challenge because it was built around a mechanic that is no longer in the game. And so looking at those early videos of Dark Souls 2 where literally, you know, there are skeletons emerging from the darkness and people have to react so quickly and, you know, be really careful as they venture, and then, you know, lighting lanterns as they go is a mark of progress, not because it's a checkpoint, but because it illuminates, you know, a certain amount of space that feels more like a safe haven. It's easier to not get snuck up on there. That layer is really cool. I think if this is a four layer cake, maybe darkness increases to the third layer where everything is much darker, but then there is equally so kind of an unnatural light from the fourth layer that, you know, it seems like as you start
that's
breaking
the evil
through,
that bleeds through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the kind of Lovecraftian force, this kind of alien force that as you've been dreading the darkness throughout your entire playthrough, eventually you come to this area that has this kind of, you know, weird blue illumination, and it feels comforting at first, but at the same time, it feels completely alien to the world that you've inhabited, and it feels threatening. And then equally so, because there's this kind of push from both sides of, you know, the safety of the natural light coming in from the bottom, it also makes sense that there is a color-coded unnatural light of this kind of evil light shining in from down below when you choose to break the ceiling at that lower level and then let that evil light emanate upwards. Nice symmetry.
I like that. And then you start playing with the concept of how much of the now are you willing to compromise, and how much of the now are you willing to break apart in order to really treat the underlayers, right? Maybe you need to expose even more, like, to mitigate the bleed through of the sort of, I guess, dark light is a potential potential term, but yeah, to mitigate that dark light, you could break and get more moonlight, sunlight, whatever. And so now you can mitigate those things, but obviously, like, you're also battling against, will I be left with just, you know, a single floating island shell of the real world just to make the path of the you know, lower layers safer for me.
We're out of time on that one. I really like where this one ended up.
Very cool. You've put some good thought into the pitch too. I mean, it's not just like, hey, let's do another one.
Well, thank you. Let's give it a name. I'd love to keep the kind of Bloodborne format, maybe not just a Bloodborne 2, but something evocative. Like, I like Darklight, like you said, maybe Blood Below or Blood Light or Blood. It sounds like Bud Light.
Blood Light. As cold as
oh my gosh.
The chorus is cold as the Rockies.
Blood Light is kind of funny though. I mean, it's evocative if not for the rhyme.
I know, but we've got Dead Earth in this episode. We could have a real good dark episode if we have a serious. Mm-hmm. Is there like, this kind of sounds cheesy too, but it's like Blood Below or something like that.
Blood. That was one of the ones I was thinking about. I mean, it's fine with me. I think especially combined all into one word could be an interesting title to look at.
Okay.
I think that suits it.
Well, this is the episode with Dead Earth and Blood Below. We've got an aesthetic happening here.
That's right. We got that 2021 energy.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right. Let's head over to our community. We have a submission from Matt Parker who says, how about a game where you're a photojournalist of some sort? Imagine GTA Online, but all you've got is a camera or dropping into a PUBG to grab the best action shots. Have you seen the movie Nightcrawler? Something like an 18 plus version of Pokemon Snap. Very cool. Starting the clock. Of course, wanted to mention that we've done some kind of war photography type games before. Again, not to say that, not to shame people for sending in similar ideas. We welcome that. And even if the exact same idea was submitted, then we commit to taking things in a different direction to the best of our ability and memory. but yeah, for further reading, I'll try to find the episode name on that one, but we've explored similar ideas. So let's find ways to perhaps layer into the PUBG aspect. I think that's interesting, of having a kind of like maybe like a one life, one run, maybe somewhat roguish type of experience. I don't know. What are you feeling?
I do think it's, I mean, one of the things when Matt talks about PUBG in here is we've kind of, like, all battle royales in many ways are formatted such that it's safe to assume if you see another person on the map, they are an enemy combatant. But the idea of, think about like how robust photo modes are in games now, and could we have a PUBG where there's 100, you know, combatants dropped on the map, but there's also like 20 journalists? And their responsibilities, it's like it's kind of asymmetrical, but it's almost two different multiplayer games happening at the same time. where the journalists are dropped in and their job is to kind of go full photo mode and document it, but the journalists are trying to survive the affair. The journalists potentially need, you know, protective equipment in the same way that the players do. Maybe the journalists need weapons or something in the way that the players do in order to defend. Maybe there's, you know, bots or something on the map as well that are there. And so now what you've actually could do is create the true warfare like scenario that PUBG kind of, you know, is really on the edge of being very isolated.
Interesting. Just to circle back to the previous point, the war photography game that I was speaking about earlier was from Playwright episode 10, a long time ago, called Viewfinder. It was the second of the games that we pitched on Playwright 10. So
it's a good name too.
If you want to listen to something similar, could check that one out. But back to this idea. I do like this sense of being both a combatant and a photographer. There's a game that came out last year called Umurangi Generation. Do you know this one at all?
I've heard the Waypoint crew talk about it a ton. And I understand what it is. And I even understand probably some light spoilers for it. But is it PC only? Maybe that's why I haven't gotten my hands on it.
Might be. I have it for PC. I don't know about other platforms. But it's a photography game where essentially you're going on photo scavenger hunts in, in the middle of a city that seems to be in some type of a military revolution. And so, at the beginning, you're just kind of taking pictures of fairly peaceful scenes of people kind of hanging out on a rooftop or down in kind of alleyways. But eventually you do start to see more of this kind of war imagery creep in, and eventually you find yourself kind of in combat zones, not necessarily a danger to yourself, but, you know, your core objective is still photography. But it does add an interesting flavor and wrinkle to this game. I do like this level of kind of environmental storytelling. By kind of looking at what's happening around you. I think if this was, if this was something where you have to kind of balance combat and photography, almost like a Dead Rising in a way, you know, I think there's you'd really have to emphasize the scoring would be based on the photographs rather than the combat. Like, combat would just be a way of like staying safe and, perhaps kind of carving your way towards more interesting photographs. I mean, this could almost be a single player, you know, remove it from the war type of element and make it more like you're hunting, you know, monsters in the swamps of Louisiana or something like that, you know, like a supernatural type of excursion. I don't know. What are you thinking about?
I mean, I like the idea of taking a bunch of people who are in a hostile world. I mean, in this case, right, there's the question of, is this a single player thing or is this a multiplayer thing? And I think games have gotten so good at photo modes, and we've even, you know, there's been interesting, got all the way back to Fatal Frame mechanics of how you could interpret the act of snapping the photo or taking the picture. But I think what hasn't broken through in mainstream kind of ways that a computer could score a photo, you know, because photos are so, you know, photography is so interpretive. It's so, you know, it's more art than science in many ways. But I'm thinking about recently, while I'm waiting for them to patch Cyberpunk, I've been playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla. The photo mode in that game is extraordinary. Not just the tool set. I think the tool set is cool, but the instantaneous pause and I'm in the photo mode with a click of a couple joysticks at basically any point has made me engage with that tool a lot more than I would have otherwise. And I'm finding it delightful to kind of look at my world map and see, oh, here's a photo taken by, you know, other people on my friends list. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you had an Assassin's Creed type thing, but you're really just playing Imagine Ubisoft is so well positioned to do this, but you are playing a character. You could really make it you. It doesn't have to have any of the preface of virtual world versus real world. But you had all the same climbing and things, and instead you just had this world map where you could see all of the photos taken by community people everywhere. And so when you discover a view or you discover an angle through the photos that you're seeing from the community, and you're like, okay, I guess I'm going to hike up this mountain, you know, in my playthrough today and get to the top so I can try and get this shot. But in the same way in real life, a photographer is like, I have to physically get to that location to get that shot. Maybe there's a way to do that. And if you add in the layer of there's creatures, there's wild beasts, all that sort of thing, maybe some are incredibly rare, like you have in the Pokemon universe, just an open world Pokemon, you know, game with the controls, format, and fidelity of a modern day Assassin's Creed that was all about taking photos. That's my dream, man. That sounds awesome.
I like this. So So a point that you brought up is that it can be difficult for computers to kind of algorithmically judge photographs.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of tools that are available. Like a computer can tell what is in frame. It can even tell to a degree how well the shot is framed. You know, there's a lot of room there for interpretation and personal judgment due to, you know, just aesthetics. But it can tell if a vital part of what you're trying to photograph is obscured or off frame or something like that. And it can even tell what objects in frame are doing. So catching somebody in mid combat is better than catching them just kind of sitting on the ground somewhere.
Yeah. I mean,
So like what kind of like photo tools do we want to provide players to create more interesting and evocative shots?
One of the things that I think about is the way that the technology handles this, and how if I'm a person and I can kind of take out the camera and then I'm looking through the viewfinder and getting the camera's views, the idea of having some things on the joystick or the controller mapped to what more of a traditional camera DSLR would have, like, okay, now my bumpers are f-stops and my triggers could be ISO or exposure and those type of things, but make the controller feel akin to actually operating a camera, I think would be great. Because right now it just more feels like kind of pointing and manipulating a video game camera. Maybe Umurangi does this better. But and on top of that, I'm also thinking like the way that we have things like dynamic resolution scaling, or there's quality versus performance modes, as you snap that shutter, the game actually is kicking off an incredibly high quality render of what was in that viewfinder. Forget about 4K, like could the asset quality in the game render a true DSLR quality 12 megapixel, 24 megapixel image? If it takes a couple minutes to process, but still it knows what's in that frame. So dial way up and like imagine a companion website where you have all these, you could buy or even print archival quality things. And, you know, suddenly people are hanging up around their house photography from a game rather than real life. I think that would be so cool to fuse those hobbies.
Right on. Let's go ahead and close that one down. Let's come up with a name for it.
Thinking about what they call like landscape photographers, or if there's like landscape photography or work, you know, photojournalist type of terms. Looking up photojournalism synonyms, which is probably not going to be good. There's a really cool term called rotograver, but it's more about a printing mechanism than it is photography.
It is very cool, though.
One of the things, I don't want to like expand the pitch too much, but you could do like dark room or something where that would be very on theme for this episode. But but if you had a mechanic where you didn't actually see the true finished product of the photo that you took until you kind of went back to your base and developed the photos in some way.
That's interesting. Darkroom is a good name. It's also thinking about like Flashpoint, That has to be a name of like 1,000 games by now.
Yeah, it sounds good though.
It is both like a conflict and a photography term, but there have to be.
Yeah, it's like there's definitely a horror game named Shudder already, but that's also.
Shudder Island, that can be our official.
Shudder
Island? Anyways, Darkroom, I mean, Darkroom is pretty good.
Okay, well, that's probably taken too, but let's, you know, this is Playwright. This
Whatever,
is
the, we'll deal with the...
This is Darkroom in parentheses 2021.
All right. Thank you again, Matt Parker, for sending that in. And if you would like to submit a video game pitch of your own, you can do so by going to playwrightcast.com/pitch. You can tweet us at playwrightcast, or you can email us playwrightcast@gmail.com.
That was pretty good. After a vacation, too. You were
I remember all of our web presences.
Special thank you to Protodome for the use of our theme song, Hello World, off the album Blue Noise. And while you're listening to things, why not go check out the latest episodes from the Kane and Rince podcast, the Sound of Play podcast, and the Sausage Factory.
All right, to take us out of the show, I believe that you are coming in with a redacted game.
Yeah, I hope it's on trend for this episode, but it might break everything. Here we go. Your redacted game. In Redacted, the player assumes the role of Redacted as he delivers Redacted to Redacted. Sorry, that's not a particularly helpful opening line. There, the imprisoned Redacted have set up a trap, an immersive combat gaming experience unfolds. With an original script penned by Emmy Award-winning Redacted writer Paul Dini, the game brings the universe of Redacted to life with stunning graphics. It continues, Redacted offers players the chance to battle Redacted with Redacted's physical and psychological strength in a graphically distinct and story-driven game.
Okay, all right. So
it's a robust one.
Yeah, there's a lot of information there, and I wish I knew who Paul Dini was. That would probably make this so much easier.
I was so confident that you wouldn't. I left his name in.
I'm not going to look it up. So it sounds like this is based on a pre-existing property. It's one of those brings it to life, which makes me think like it sounds like a book or a graphic novel or something like that. So I'll be thinking down those lines. This is interesting. There's a sense of delivery going on here. And then conflict when the delivery is made or maybe right before the delivery is made.
Yes.
I'm going to throw out kind of a broad general question. Is this a Lord of the Rings game?
Oh, that's a fantastic question, but the answer is no.
Okay. Interesting. All right, skipping the kind of like meta details of artists involved and Emmys involved, like, could we refresh on the like story elements?
Yeah, with an original script penned by Emmy Award-winning...
Okay, this is the part I don't want.
Oh, okay, sorry. Oh, the opening.
Yeah, essentially.
Okay, in Redacted, the player assumes the role of Redacted as he delivers Redacted to Redacted. There, the imprisoned Redacted have set a trap... and an immersive combat gaming experience unfolds. So there's some combat going on in here.
So I guess what I'm trying to determine is whether the delivery is the crux of the game or whether that is like backstory for the trap that is the central conceit of the game.
Right. Is the game about the trap?
Whether it's like a Last of Us type game where the delivery is the thrust or whether that's just backstory. All right. Do we have kind of... What kind of metadata do we have on this one? What would be useful?
I think this will help. Okay. This is the number 4 best Xbox 360 game of 2009.
Okay.
The number 4 most discussed Xbox 360 game of 2009.
Pretty early in the 360 lifespan.
And the number 9 most shared.
All right. Is this Gears of War?
That's a great guess as well. It is not Gears of War. I won't count the Lord of the Rings one as that's a framing question.
Yeah. That feels pretty specific.
Okay. All right. Fair.
All right. Not Gears of War. All right. So you play a male protagonist delivering something or someone. So when this delivery is made and this trap is triggered, is it because the group receiving the delivery is double crossing the person? Like, did they think they were friends and then the trap is them double crossing? Or is it that the delivery was something that they didn't want, like he's delivering a bomb or something like that?
Oh my God. The best way I can answer that is neither of those scenarios is true. That a more specific answer is the delivery might in some ways even be known or assumed to be a trap in and of itself.
Was the person delivering a trap, or was he knowingly walking into a trap?
I would say knowingly walking into a trap by nature of the delivery.
This also does have the kind of drama of a God of War game, but completely wrong platform for that.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be it.
I think some key things to pull out here is definitely that you're delivering a thing to Redacted. They're the imprisoned Redacted have set up a trap and an immersive combat gaming experience unfolds. You could probably end the entire game description.
Oh, gosh.
There.
Okay. But there's not a delivery. I don't know if I want this to be my last guess. No, I don't think that's it. The imprisoned.
The reference material must have at some point be prolific or influential enough to, you know, be considered for an Emmy at some point. So maybe more popular entertainment.
Okay. All right. So is the... Okay. So just to remind me of, like, this is not asking for further information. This is just clarification of what's already on the table. So the Emmy, when that was brought up, is that in relation to the writer who they named? Does he have an Emmy from other work, or is this work itself or the series it was based on like Emmy material? Does that make sense?
Yes, that does.
Is the Emmy related to this?
First, I'll read the statement and you tell me if you're left with it not being clear. With an original script penned by Emmy award-winning Redacted writer Paul Dini, the game brings the universe of Redacted to life with stunning graphics.
Are those two Redacteds the same thing?
They're very closely related.
Okay. All right.
They one is a subset of the other. I know that, man, I'm trying to not muddy the waters, but that was kind of a...
I have interesting avenues I kind of want to explore, but I don't know if I want it to be last guess quality.
Yeah.
So anyways, without confirming or denying anything, so I don't burn through guesses, just to make this more engaging for the listener. So, you know, don't react necessarily, because I don't want this to, I don't want to put my toe in the water and that to be a cheating moment, but just to keep other people engaged and where my mind's at right now. I was originally thinking of Spec Ops The Line, because there's not really a delivery that's going on there, but you are kind of stepping knowingly into a trap, and you can kind of argue that the forces there are imprisoned, but I don't know if they specifically use that word, so I'm not that confident on this. This also feels somewhat Walking Dead, but again, I don't know if imprisoned is the right word, although I know that many of the Walking Dead fictional outages take place in prisons or something, so maybe that's like the name of one of the Walking Dead tribes. I don't know.
Let me, I will give you as a last contextualized thing, a highly rated review and a poorly rated review.
Okay, cool.
The good review is, without a doubt, the best Redacted game ever created, and probably one of the best video games in the Redacted genre. Finally, Redacted has been done justice in video game form. So that's the good one.
Okay.
Maybe I'm playing a different game, but the Redacted game I'm playing suffers from clunky controls and okay graphics. The gameplay is only so-so. I've only played the game for an hour and a half, but so far I'm not enjoying it. But the critics love it, so what do I know? So, well-acclaimed, maybe the best of its genre. Though this genre is... Yeah, I think it... I don't know if I would think about it as a genre. Maybe a little clunky on the way it controls.
Interesting. There was a part of the Redacted description after the, like, Emmys and all of that, right? Wasn't there, like, a third section?
It's Redacted offers players the chance to battle Redacted with Redacted's physical and psychological strength in a graphically distinct and story-driven game.
Ah. physical and psychological is very interesting.
Yeah.
That kind of, I was leaning towards Dark Messiah of Might and Magic, but the psychological aspect kind of takes that off the table. I'm feeling like this with the psychological aspect feels more like an RPG or a CRPG or a strategy type of game, maybe. Nah, but they talk about clunky controls. That feels more immediate. Mm.
And combat's important, right? An immersive combat gaming experience unfolds.
That's right. Gosh, I feel like this is going to be one that I'm going to immediately know once things stop being redacted. I wish I could figure out what universe it was set within. I mean, that would make it too easy.
2009, Xbox 360, also on PC and PlayStation 3.
Okay. All right. So not a single platform game. Gosh, I have an answer that feel like kind of fits the bill, but it's kind of stupid and I don't want to burn it on that. If it is though, that would be hilarious. You know what?
I mean, and you got to think, Holden, before you answer, you got to think number 4 best Xbox 360 game of 2009.
Gosh, this it's is definitely not well, that though.
Yeah. It's a definitely well-known, like one of the standouts that people think of when they think of that generation.
Okay. All right. Then I'm not going to burn it on Peter Jackson's King Kong. everything kind of fits. I mean,
kind of weird. You're right. Stunning graphics. There's some, it's graphically distinct, story driven. Yes.
Here we go. Okay. You know what? Actually, I feel good about this. Is this Batman Arkham Asylum?
Ding, 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 ding.
Oh my gosh. Wow. What a journey.
With this original script penned by Emmy Award winning Batman writer Paul Dini, the game brings the universe of DC Comics detective to life with stunning graphics. Batman Arkham Asylum offers players the chance to battle Gotham's worst villains with, I had to do some multi-word redactions here, I apologize, yeah, with Batman's physical and psychological strength in a graphically distinct and story-driven game.
Wow, gosh, I was, that was like a last-minute revelation.
Beautifully done. Yeah, I kind of wanted to hold back by saying, in some ways, like, the combat was the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also hesitated from telling you that it is delivering something that one does not usually assume is for delivery. In this case, a person.
Oh, yeah, because he was delivering the Joker.
Yeah, yeah. But it's all in the first like 5 minutes of the
Joel situation.
Right. Right. He just kind of shows up. He's like, yeah, the Joker's here. And even the opening of the game is just Batman being like, yeah, this is definitely a damn trap. And here I am, though.
Interesting. Well, very, very good one. That one was way harder than I would expect a game that mainstream to have ever been.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't even talk about it. It is 92 on Metacritic. So very, very nice.
Yep. That sounds about right. Great game. Great series. Anyways, that'll do it for our first show of 2021. Thank you everyone for listening. We'll catch you again next week.
Bye.